morning. Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program that is devoted to those of you who recognize that all of the world's religious, political, military, academic, and media institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, that they are working against your interests, that the fact that they are doing everything wrong, everything in a way that is hostile to the interest of those they claim to serve, can't be because they are all stupid, which means they're doing it deliberately. Turning to the news, a large coalition of advocacy groups, this is the story that we were covering at the end of our news hour yesterday, went to the U.S. Department of Education, I really should say of indoctrination, to pressure colleges, one, to punish students for their speech. Punish students for their speech. Now, the U.S. government operates under a constitution. The First Amendment to that constitution makes that request unconstitutional. Punish students for their speech. And two, block students from certain websites. Imagine that. That there's a large coalition of advocacy groups, many of them women's advocacy groups, many of them Muslim advocacy groups, that are pressuring the U.S. government to punish students for their speech and block access to certain websites, to information. It is beyond astonishing that we live in a nation that professes values that it is all too willing to completely and totally invert. Now, it says some of the speech that the group mentions consists of actual threats, threats of violence, including threats to attack and to rape. But such speech is already constitutionally unprotected, which is to say, you know, you can't threaten to harm, threaten to kill, threaten to rape someone. That's illegal. Always been illegal. You don't need a new law to make that illegal. What they want illegal is for you to be able to criticize Islam, for example. They want you to be able to criticize their promotion of homosexuality. They want to criminalize their promotion of socialist, humanist, secularism. And so if you are not swallowing their Kool-Aid, they want the ability to punish students for not acquiescing to their agenda. So in this particular case, what we have is an attack on free speech. Why? Because free speech is the single most effective tool in the world to use against the malfeasance of religion and government. It won't work on all people, may not even work on most people, but there is nothing that will work on most people. And it won't work on people who are overly religious or on people who are overly political because they are immune to evidence and reason. They believe. And so, realizing that nothing you can do is going to be effective without those people. Evidence doesn't matter. Reason doesn't matter. Truth doesn't matter. But there are a significant number of people who are still open-minded, who still know how to exercise good judgment. And with those people, the only tool that is effective is evidence and reason. They don't want you to be able to reach them. And they don't want you to be able to criticize their malfeasance. So no free speech. It's only a matter of time before free speech becomes illegal in any public forum. The internet, radio, television, newspapers, you name it. This story is just amazing. What's most amazing about the story is not the fact that this idiotic woman is promoting such nonsense. It's that she's being paid to do it by the French government. Mostly it's annoying that the person telling the story is telling the story of this bright star that's and religious circles, and they're not smart enough to question what she says. That's the problem with journalism today. The attempt of journalism doesn't, the people who engage in journalism have been so indoctrinated in political correctness, they've lost the ability to be judgmental, to exercise good judgment. They can't be discerning. They don't know right from wrong, truth from lies. And so I'm going to tell the story as it's reported, and I'm going to criticize it as this journalist should have done. Anthropologist Dunia Bazahar used to try religious arguments to turn people away from militant Islam and failed. So the 51-year-old grandmother developed her own techniques along the lines of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her main rule is, don't try to reason with people. By the way, there's nothing along the lines of Alcoholics Anonymous in her plan. It's her own techniques. Now, why would she give up on religious arguments? Because you can't make a religious argument against jihad, against terrorism, against rape, against enslaving children, against pedophilia. You cannot make a religious argument against theft, against the destruction of people and property using Islam. Because everything in Islam says exactly the opposite. That Allah demands that you become a jihadist. That Allah demands that you lay in wait to kill non-Muslims. And that you continue to fight and kill non-Muslims until the entire world is under the dominion of Islam. That's what the Quran demands. The Quran demands that you be a terrorist. The Quran condemns anyone who is peaceful, including a peaceful Muslim, calling them a hypocrite. The Quran orders good Muslims to kill moderate Muslims. So there is no way to use a religious argument against Islamic jihad. So she's failed 100% of the time. Then she says she failed when she tried evidence and reason. Well, of course, if you use evidence and reason, you will only prevail with an individual who is motivated to be persuaded by evidence and reason. A religious person never is. It doesn't matter if the religion is Christianity or Islam or even Judaism. If you tell any of the devotees of any one of those religions, including socialist secular humanism, if you tell them the truth, if you expose the error in their mythology, it just rolls off them like water off a duck's back. They are immune to evidence and reason. And so that also failed. So she said, I don't try to reason with people. But the journalist here couldn't point out why she couldn't use a religious argument. Because there is no religious argument against jihad in the Quran. In fact, as Baghdadi's most recent sermon points out, you can give an hour sermon and quote passage after passage from the Quran and Hadith, demanding that all Muslims, as an obligatory duty, engage in jihad. So she says, characteristically, a young person who has been recruited thinks that he is chosen and that he knows the truth, says the bleach blonde, discreetly watched by three police bodyguards as she sat in a Parisian cafe. Now, why, if she was trying to persuade people not to be violent, would she need three bodyguards? I ask you that question. You know, hey, I'm exposing and condemning Islam on a regular basis. You know how many bodyguards I have? None. Why would she need three bodyguards? Unless the expected Islamic response to whatever she is saying and doing is to want to kill her. Well, she says that this person thinks that he knows the truth. No, they don't think they know the truth. They believe. They don't think. So as soon as you try to use reason or knowledge to tackle this type of young person, you're failing. This tells it all. Buzar, a Muslim herself, instead uses memories, music, and even smells to try to win young militants back. Now, if you are a Muslim, you are either ignorant or you're irrational. It is impossible to be a knowing and reasonable Muslim. The Quran is such a ridiculous book. Muhammad was such a pathetic person that there are 10,000 irrefutable arguments that can be wielded at Islam's credibility, and there isn't a single argument that can be wielded in its favor. If you are the least bit knowledgeable, if you are the least bit rational, you cannot be a Muslim. Now, I will tell you that it's impossible to be a wholly knowledgeable and rational Christian. But in the case of Christianity, Paul's plot was more insidious. It was more carefully constructed. And it is a little bit harder to recognize the fallacy in Pauline Christianity. It's not hard. It's just a little harder. Islam is just the dumbest religion ever conceived. The most violent, the most destructive, the most counterproductive. It is literally the inverse of the truth rather than a corruption of the truth. It's like trying to pass off a $100 bill that was printed pink with a bunny rabbit on it for president. And, you know, you're just going to say, wait a minute, this isn't even close. And would be rejected by anybody who is the least bit aware out of hand. Well, that's the case of Islam. So if she is a Muslim, then the reason that she can't prevail with evidence and reason is because she doesn't know the truth, and she's irrational. Anyway, what she's using is music. If she was a Muslim, she couldn't use music. Muhammad hated music. And therefore, in Sharia law, you're not allowed to play music or listen to music. She uses smells. Can you imagine that you're going to use smells to persuade someone not to be religious? I mean, they use smells to, as part of the overall religious experience. That's the whole nature of incense. But oh my goodness. Recruiters have adopted the techniques developed by cults, she says, so it takes different skills to break their hold. No, they haven't developed techniques that are used by cults. Islam is an extraordinarily effective religion in luring young men. And when the religion is understood, you recognize that Allah is a terrorist and he wants all Muslims to be terrorists. That Allah is a sexist and that women exist for men to abuse. Not to love. Not just to control. To abuse. In any way that they see fit. And that in Islam, stealing is good. Rape is good. Pedophilia is good. The slave trade is good. Killing is good. Everything that you would normally consider bad is good, and so you can be recruited into Islam by promising the devotee the same things Muhammad promised. You get to keep what you steal. You get extra bonus points if you kill. That Allah loves killers. And that you get to rape and control women along the way. Abuse them any way you wish. As for the women, it's the Stockholm Syndrome. They are treated in such a way that they're considered completely worthless by their parents, by their religion. They have no merit in the Quran. And so women are seeking any indication that they have some merit. You know, here they can't even walk out of their houses without being hidden in tents. They have to walk behind their husbands. They have infinitely fewer rights than their sons. And so they're looking for something, someone to say, hey, you know, it's kind of like if you're in a state completely deprived of any attention, you'll do anything to feel. And so it's the lure of the lie here is they just want to feel like, well, if I devote myself to the jihadists and become a jihadi sex slave, then Allah is going to appreciate me, not recognizing that, according to Muhammad, hell is filled with women hung by their breasts because they weren't submissive enough to their husbands. Now, this moron of an anthropologist works for the Ministry of the Interior in France to train authorities in her methods. There's not a single case that can be shown that she has been effective. The official in charge of a 6 million euro program to prevent radicalization in France says that Bazaar and her team are giving results with which we are quite satisfied. Yeah, of course, she can't prove that she's done anything. It's just that that's the nature of governments. Governments spend money and there is no accountability. Neither Bazaar nor French officials suggested hers is the only answer to militant recruiting. Oh, no, I mean, who is to say that lack of reason, lack of evidence, and smells and music aren't the only answer. Bazaar says their tactics are the start of a process that might be able to work. France has lost more people to militant Islam. Just call it to Islam than any other country in Europe, according to most estimates. Two bloody attacks at home this year have emphasized the risk. The French government estimates that 2,000 citizens have joined jihadi networks in Syria and Iraq or are on the verge of doing so. Another 7,000 are at risk of following that path. Bazaar works under police protection and changes her location constantly. About one in five French radicals in Iraq and Syria are women. About 20% rather than 50%, about 20%. The reason is there is no incentive, really, to be a Muslim woman. I mean, when I see a Muslim woman wearing the hijab, I just scorn. I mean, show a look of disgust. There's no incentive to be. There's no reasonable, rational, moral incentive to be a Muslim man. I mean, the fact that you get to act upon pedophilic urges, the fact that you get to rape women, the fact that you get to steal, the fact that you get to kill all in the name of your religion, the fact that you get to destroy and enslave people, the fact that you get to be a terrorist, I don't personally view as an incentive. I'm opposed to all of those things. But at least if you're a pervert, if you are murderous, if you are a disgusting human being, as a man, those things might appeal to you. But women get nothing. And nothing for a woman in Islam. And still, about 40% of women acquiesce. Talk about stupid. Only a minority of the radicals, what a terrible term to use for a fundamentalist. Bazaar helps come from Muslim families, she says. About 80% were originally atheist or Catholics. Some are even Jewish. You know how many Jewish Muslims there are in the world? You know how many former atheist Muslims there are in the world? I mean, the number of Muslims that weren't born Muslims is infinitesimal. No one can come from atheism to Islam. No one can come from being Jewish to Islam. I mean, it's to make that leap from something that at least is to some degree, and to a large degree, evidence and reason-based, into the realm of utter stupidity, utter perversity, utter immorality. For you to say that 80%, I mean, if you were to say that about 10% were former Christians, I'd say, all right, that's probably stretching it. She's not reaching fundamentalists. But to say that 80% were former atheists, Catholics, or Jewish is to say this woman is a complete and utter fraud. There aren't 80% of fundamentalist Muslims who came from anything other than Islam And it doesn't even approach that. I mean, it's not even the number of fundamentalist Muslims in the world that came from Christianity at large is probably less than 1% of jihadi Muslims worldwide. The number of jihadi Muslims worldwide that were formerly Jewish isn't even 1/1,000th of 1%. The number of fundamentalist Muslims engaged in jihad worldwide who came from atheism is also less than 1%. So at very most, you could have 2%. And she claims 80? This woman is a complete and utter fraud, as is the religion that she embraces. Her methods are sometimes controversial, yes, as are her claims. Her cases cannot be independently verified. How do you like the French woman that's responsible for the $5 million budget saying, oh, we're very pleased with her results? Well, nothing she does can be verified because she disguises all of her results for the sake of privacy. Her critics say she's no expert in Islam, can't even speak Arabic, and is playing with amateur psychology. Well, she is clearly no expert on Islam. That would be absolutely fundamentally true. If you were an expert on Islam, you're going to either be a jihadi or you're going to be exposing and condemning the religion based upon evidence and reason. The fact that you can't speak Arabic has nothing to do with Islam. I know Muslims love to wield that card, but it's totally and completely meaningless. You need to speak to people in the language they understand, first of all. And second of all, the Quran isn't written in Arabic. It's written in Hebrew. Every important word in the Quran is Hebrew. The Arabic alphabet is the Hebrew alphabet. You want to understand the Quran? You better understand Hebrew. And every text in the world that is intelligently written can be translated into any other language, and its message can be communicated. That's the nature of words. Words have a counterpart in every language. So if a document is written in Hebrew, for example, I don't have to speak Hebrew, but I have to understand Hebrew. I have to be able to look at the words in Hebrew and render them in English if I'm communicating to an English audience. We'll be back. Bazaar, who was a social worker dealing with delinquent at-risk young people for 15 years, has a team. Oh, she has a whole team whose members have all experienced the loss or recruitment. They have all experienced the loss or recruitment. I don't know what they mean. And have plenty of experience with radicalized youth. Have all experienced the loss or the recruitment. Maybe the journalist can't write either. They certainly can't think. In 2004, she started a project with 10 people who were radicalizing and published a book about it. She started a project with 10 people who were radicalizing. Sounds like she was working on the other side. Sounds like she is just a hired gun. Whoever is willing to give me money, I'll pretend that I'm producing results for them. Maybe she actually is a good Muslim. Maybe she's just a weasel. 2 years later, while working with an imam to convince young boys they were on the wrong path, she realized she was failing. Yeah. The imam spoke about religion, she says. The youth would reply, "Shut your face. That's what Allah says. I'm chosen. I know what Allah says." Yeah. Read the Quran, idiot. How would you talk to somebody about Islam and completely contradict the Quran? What are you going to do? I'm saying that you shouldn't be a jihadist, but the imam, who is reading from the Quran, and Allah, who is speaking out of the pages of the Quran, says you must be a jihadist. Oh, goodness. Things got more complicated early last year when the Islamic State brothers began hunting online for wives. Many of their French recruits were well-educated and came from stable backgrounds. These adolescents are undergoing the process of suggestion, which is almost at the level of hypnosis.
religions are very good at being bad. You know, a religion doesn't survive for 14 centuries unless it is very, very good at being bad. Christianity has survived really since the time of the fall of the Roman Empire, right around 300 CE is when Christianity began to take shape. And so it's been around almost 17 centuries, Islam 14 centuries. Religions don't prevail unless they're very good at being bad. They were always good at being bad. It's, you know, it's the whole mindset, the whole psyche, the whole apparatus of religion with their giant monuments, with their priests, with the catastrophic consequence to people in societies if they don't acquiesce, if they don't submit to the religious authority. And so, for centuries, religions have prevailed by making it almost impossible, very difficult, certainly painful, for a person to resist them. This is an interesting deal. Boko Haram means that haram is evil, and essentially Boko is books. So they're talking about, they mean to say that any source of non-Islamic knowledge, which would be any source of knowledge, is forbidden. So the Islamic group Boko Haram has released photos showing a rocket-making factory in northeastern Nigeria, a rocket-making factory. Now, what this thing is, there's not even a gravel or concrete or asphalt floor. There's not a wall. There's not a roof. So you've got this factory out in the dirt. No floor, no walls, no ceiling. You think that would be kind of the bottom line to call something a factory. No, this is just out in a field underneath some trees. It looks like there's a really dilapidated tent next by, nearby. The tools in the factory is that they have two air compressors. Yep, two air compressors. They've got some hacksaws and they've got some steel tubes. And with the hacksaws and steel tubes and the air compressors, they are painting their pipes a dark green. The air compressors, clearly not made in a Muslim country, clearly made by somebody who didn't think that books were harmful. And here they are making these rockets, but to call it a rocket factory, wow. And it's interesting, a group got the technical know-how to manufacture weapons, and yet they won't read a Western book. A monthly record of 220,000 Muslim refugees reached Europe by sea alone. You know, most of them are coming through Turkey by land. They're walking. That's the vast preponderance of them. But 200,000 came by sea. This is in a month. That would mean that between walking and by sea, in one month, there were a million of them. A million in a month. And a million in the month before that. And a million the month before that. The number reaching Greece was 210,000 for Italy, 10,000. Many of the refugees are from Syria. Although the second most of them are from Afghanistan, the third most are from Iraq, the fourth most are from Libya, the fifth most are from Islamic nations in Central and Northern Africa. About 70 people drowned just this week trying to reach the Greek island. The bodies of four men were recovered in the Aegean Sea. I saw a story on Kerry. I can't find the story. I read it this morning on my iPad. But this was just wanted to report the stupidity of what he's doing. He was in Turkmenistan. And in Turkestan, he was he's taking a tour of the Caucasus region, these all Islamic regions. The government there has taken a hard line against fundamentalist Islamic groups. They've done the same thing in Turkmenistan as you've seen Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi do. Saddam Hussein would not tolerate a fundamentalist Islamic jihadist group. They were outlawed. They were illegal in his country. Muammar Gaddafi did exactly the same thing. A fundamentalist Islamic terrorist group was illegal in his country. And so when the United States invaded those countries and deposed those men, then you could be an Islamic jihadist, and all of a sudden those nations were being destroyed with Islamic terrorism. So here we have, for example, in Egypt, we had a dictator that was wholly and completely intolerant of the Muslim Brotherhood. America says, no, you've got to be fair and democratic. So the Muslim Brotherhood got elected, and then the jihadists were out in the open. So America then sponsored a military coup with America's military hardware so that you could have an intolerant dictator who recognizes that Islam in its fundamentalist stage brings terror and anarchy. And so Sisi, who is a Muslim, won't tolerate Islamic jihad. He won't tolerate any Islamic group. And so here's Kerry in Turkmenistan, and he's lecturing the government there that they should stop prosecuting fundamentalist Islamic groups. He says, you know, when you're outlawing and you're persecuting these fundamentalist Islamic groups as political groups and religious groups, and that's going to backfire on you. What you need to do is be more accepting, more tolerant, and everything will just turn out swell. Can you imagine? I don't think it's possible that he could be that stupid, that he didn't realize that by tolerating freedom and the opportunity to coalesce and to discharge their will of fundamentalist Islamic groups, we turned Iraq and Syria and Libya, by deposing those who were intolerant of Islamic terrorism, into terrorist hellholes. And so now he's telling the Turkmenistan government that has Islamic terrorism under control because they're intolerant of it, that that's not the right way to go. You need to do what America does and let them express themselves. I don't think it's possible that he's that stupid, which means that he is that evil. European observers have said that violence in the run-up to the election in Turkey, in which the Justice and Development Party, you might just call it the Islamic Party, regained its majority, was intolerable, and that there was a specific increase in violence, particularly in the southeast where the Kurds live, that restricted not only contestants to campaign freely, but anyone to support them. It also criticized, European observers, the curbs that were put on the media. And freedom of the media. Curbs, yeah. If you did not endorse Erdogan, your home, your offices were ransacked. You were put in prison. You were labeled a terrorist if you didn't support the Islamist dictator and his party. Anyone who didn't support him was harassed by the government. And yet, the Turkish president, why you would call this man a president, let's just call him what he is, a dictator, Recep Erdogan, called on the world to respect the result of his election, even though there was no freedom in the media, no freedom of press, no free speech, and that 40 million people, the Kurds, were consistently bombed and harassed during the entire process. And the most effective candidate has been labeled a terrorist whom the government is trying to imprison. He has got asylum in the United States. So the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, PACE, went on to denounce the entire process as completely unfair. And yet, he demands that the world respect it. Why would we respect a dictator who has manipulated the system? I ask you that. In a statement on Monday, Sanchez Amor, head of the European Observatory mission, said that physical attacks on party members, as well as the significant security-related concerns, particularly in the southeast, had a tremendous effect on campaigning. He added that pressure on journalists, including police raids on the media, was a major concern. Unfortunately, the campaign for these elections was characterized by unfairness and, to a serious degree, fear. And we want to call Turkey a democracy? It's one-party rule. The one party is Islamic. And even though the vast majority of Turks are fundamentalist Muslims, this party is so disgusting that it had to use fear and unfairness. It had to cheat, to lie, and to threaten violence to prevail. Welcome to the name of Islam and the AK party, which is political and religious Islam, and to see the tactics that they will use. So for anybody that wants to pretend that Turkey is a democracy, God, shake the cobwebs out of your head. Open your eyes. It is nothing but similar to all the other Islamic countries. It's a dictatorship. Prosecutors in Lebanon have charged a Saudi prince with drug smuggling. The prince, who was not named, but he and four other Saudis were arrested after 2 tons of Capricorn pills, 2 tons of Capricorn pills were found in cases being loaded onto their private jet. 2 tons. You know what? I've owned 3 or 4 private jets. And for the most part, if I wanted to travel any distance in my private jet, and I had, let's just say, myself and one other pilot in the airplane, and maybe 4 passengers, I would be allowed maybe to be within the weight and balance restrictions of that aircraft, maybe 200 pounds of luggage. Well, 200 pounds versus 4,000 pounds? These boys are flying in jumbo jets. Anyway, 2 tons of narcotics. The Captagon pills, which typically contain amphetamines, are consumed widely in the Islamic world. The drug has helped fuel the conflict in Syria, generating millions of dollars in revenues for producers inside the country as well as the combatants to keep them fighting. Captagon, originally the trade name for a synthetic stimulant, was first produced in 1960s to treat hyperactivity and depression, but it was banned in most countries because it is too addictive. In 2013, the UN said 64% of global seizures of amphetamine took place in the Islamic world, in the Middle East. And so here is a Saudi prince trying to buy and then sell 2 tons of Captagon amphetamines. What's the purpose of that? To keep the jihadists fighting. So you want to pretend for a moment that Saudi Arabia is a peacemaker in this, that they seek a diplomatic solution? Saudi prince supplying 2 tons of illegal amphetamines to keep the jihadists fighting. Swell, huh? Keep them addicted. You either continue to fight, or we won't give you more narcotics. It is an extraordinarily sad situation. I read an interesting article this morning. The dateline was Damascus. A Western journalist was in Damascus and was noting the jubilance of the people, the fact that they are out partying in the streets, that they say they have hope, that there are 5 million people in Damascus who are rallying around Assad and says, you know, it looks like with the Russian help that we've turned the tide, that we can come back into the streets again, that our imminent demise is not imminent, or our demise is not imminent. And to say that Moscow's intervention in the Syrian war, from the perspective of the 5 million Syrians that are still in Syria and not trying to flee to Europe, is looked at as most favorable. They look at these 5 million Syrians that are still there, America as the enemy. Saudi Arabia as the enemy. They look at Russia as their savior. Truly amazing. Russia has found a way to keep Syrians in Syria. But United States, we want them to emigrate throughout Europe by the millions. Turning to the next item in the news, what we find is that now that Russia has shown that they can be accepted and that they have a rational strategy in Syria, NATO is saying that they need to confront it. And so there are stories now about NATO deciding that it's going to provoke Russia by stationing tens of thousands of NATO troops along the border with Russia. Can you imagine how that's going to work? How telling Russia that we're opposed to you, we're going to put military hardware all pointed at you along your border, even though you're not threatening to invade anyone. We're going to poise our troops so that they are threatening to invade you. NATO's public response is to test its new spearhead force with 5,000 troops all ready to move within a few days right along the Russian border, along with 36,000 more, 230 military units, 140 aircraft, and more than 60 ships, all as a public display against Russia. Truly amazing that we have reignited the Cold War. In a letter to President Rouhani, published on the Ayatollah Khomeini's official website, Iran's highest authority has ordered the July 4th nuclear deal to be implemented, subject to certain conditions. And the Iranian parliament stipulated them in a law last week. He said that Iran should delay doing anything with its enriched uranium. Regarding reconfiguring a heavy water reactor, and which is designed to make plutonium, until Iran's obligations, that's really Iran's only obligations under the deal, until UN inspectors had settled the issue as to whether Tehran had ever sought nuclear weapons. Any action regarding the Iraq reactor and dispatching uranium abroad will take place after the possible military dimensions file is closed, Khomeini said in a letter. Previously, the week prior, he said that Iran wouldn't even authorize any inspections until all of the sanctions were officially removed. Not just the agreement said, not just put in a status where they would be left in place, but removed only while Iran was in compliance, but that right back into effect when Iran stopped being in compliance. No, he wants them completely removed so that the world would have to go right back to ground zero when Iran violates the agreement. everything that they can do to mock the agreement, to renege on the agreement, they are doing. The story that really bothered me a great deal that came out this morning is that Netanyahu has reversed controversial statements that he made, and they were only controversial because the world doesn't want to know the truth. He said he never meant to claim that an Islamic leader, this would be the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, persuaded Adolf Hitler to adopt the final solution to kill millions of European Jews. And the fact of the matter is, that's exactly what he said, and what he said is what the Nuremberg testimony reveals. And what the reason that the Jews had a conniption fit over it is the Jews want to just blame Nazi Germany. They don't want to blame Islam, because Judaism is, as its heart, is a tolerant religion. And so they don't, it's okay in this world to be intolerant of Nazism, but it's not okay by political correctness and the standards of tolerance to be against Islam. And so they don't want the truth communicated, and they've scolded Netanyahu because of it.